Raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Ben S. Bernanke.
I, Ben S. Bernanke.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
On February 1st, 2006, the economist Ben Bernanke became the 14th chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, a job better known as Fed Chairman. He'd been a longtime creature of academia, primarily at Princeton, but in 2002, he took a job as one of seven Fed governors under Chairman Alan Greenspan. He later spent several months as the head of the Council of Economic Advisers in George Bush's White House.
It's good to be with Anna, Ben's wife, Alyssa and Joel, his sister Sharon, and the other members of the Bernanke family. Welcome. Thanks for being here. You probably didn't think your brother was going to amount to much.
So I didn't come from Texas. I wasn't part of President Bush's original team. I wasn't involved in his elections. I mean, he basically, you know, got interested in me based on my professional qualifications, my academic reputation and the like.
You write that your wife cried when you were offered the Fed chairmanship, but these were not tears of joy, at least purely not. Why? What did she foresee?
Well, she understood that it was going to be a tough job and that the public scrutiny was going to be tough. But, you know, I was really interested in the economic part of the job and the policy part of the job, and the personal stresses that came along with it were, you know, it turned out to be much worse than I expected, frankly. So that was what she was concerned about.
So she was right in some large sense. Do you
Do
you regret having taken the job? I'm curious.
Well, at some level, I mean, obviously, I got a lot more than I anticipated, and you know, but you know, it was an important time, and I feel like I made a contribution, and so I'm happy about that.
Today on Freakonomics Radio, a conversation about the financial crisis and the life story that Bernanke tells in his recent book, The Courage to Act.
I was not somebody who had all their lives wanted to be a policymaker, or certainly not Fed chairman.
He explains what FDR got right and wrong during the Great Depression, and he assesses another political giant from that era.
Ironically, and please take this the right way, the person who sort of most understood fiscal policy in some sense was Adolf Hitler.
And later this hour, we'll talk to Anne-Marie Slaughter, another academic who went to D.C., also from Princeton. But unlike Ben Bernanke, Slaughter got the public scrutiny only when she left her job.
I was suddenly a public figure, you know, with my views being distorted, with all sorts of people writing very unpleasant things, but with lots of people saying wonderful things. And it really changed my life.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Today, we are talking with the man who was essentially handed the keys to the global economy just as it started heading off a cliff.
My name is Ben Bernanke, and I am now at the Brookings Institution in Washington, and up till February of 2014, I was the chairman of the Federal Reserve.
You were indeed. And what shall we call you? Is it Mr. Chairman? Is that a lifetime honorific? What do you like to go by?
I don't think it is. I don't honestly know. There's not enough examples of, you know, emeritus chairman. I guess Ben is okay with me.
Ben? Really? You're going to let me call you Ben, Mr. Chairman?
Absolutely. Can I call you Steve?
I'd love it, but I feel like I don't deserve it, but I'm going to take advantage of it anyway. Okay,
all right,
Ben.
Why not? Yes, sir.
You write that, quote, toward the end of my tenure as chairman, I was asked what had surprised me the most about the financial crisis. The crisis, I said. Can you unpack that for a moment?
Sure. I mean, it's not that we didn't see many of the elements of it. And I made a presentation to President Bush in 2005 in the White House explaining, you know, what we thought would happen if house prices reversed and came down, as they ultimately, in fact, did. And what I got right was that it would cause a recession. What I got wrong was I didn't appreciate that the decline in house prices and the problems in the mortgage markets would generate this big panic that was, in fact, the reason why the recession was so deep. So we understood about house prices. We understood about subprime mortgages. We understood that there were risks in the financial system. What we didn't appreciate was the vulnerability of the overall system to a panic. And that panic, once it became evident, then we had to address it very vigorously.
You write that in your academic career, you were, quote, a Great Depression buff in the way that other people are Civil War buffs, and that, quote, the holy grail of macroeconomics was essentially to understand why the Depression happened and why it was so long and deep. Okay, so just transport yourself for a moment back to this time. Pick the year. I don't know what the proper year would be to forestall this, but let's say we install you as Fed chairman then. What could you have done?
Well, let me first emphasize what a puzzle it is. I mean, economists are used to thinking about market economies as working pretty well. You know, invisible hand leads to good outcomes. Most of the time, people can find work if they want to work. So here we had a situation where the world economy from 1929 until about 1941 was deeply depressed, with unemployment rates as high as 25% in the United States. Was leading to huge political disruptions, including the rise of Hitler and other fascist leaders, challenges to capitalism in the United States. It was an enormous event, and so it was very puzzling, you know, how something like that could happen in a market economy. And I don't know if we fully understand it, but it might have taken more than just the Fed chairman. But together, I think two things would have been very important, particularly from the Fed's perspective. One would have been to prevent the collapse in the money supply, and doing that, more could have been done even in the context of the gold standard that existed in the early 30s. But getting rid of the gold standard or abrogating the gold standard, which is what the UK did in 1931, for example, would have been very helpful. One of the most important things that Franklin Roosevelt did when he became president in 1933 was to take the United States off the gold standard. So that was a very important thing. The other thing, the Fed could have done more, and why they didn't actually is a bit of a puzzle. They could have done more to prevent the collapse of so many banks. They could have done what we did, the Federal Reserve did in 2007, 2008, which was to make loans to banks that were suffering from runs by their depositors, taking as collateral their loans and other investments. And by providing more liquidity to the banking system, they could have likely slowed the panic, slowed the bank runs, and avoided so many failures.
So FDR is the hero, really, in your telling of the Depression.
I shall ask the Congress for the one remaining instrument to meet the crisis. Broad executive power to wage a war against the emergency.
He tried several what you call experiments, and that, quote, collectively they worked, you write. Now, how universally accepted is that argument among economists? To my understanding, it's not universally accepted, correct?
Well, I think there are a couple things he did that were clearly helpful. The first one was going off the gold standard, allowing the money supply to grow. The second was putting in deposit insurance, which brought the bank runs, the banking panics, to an end. And I think almost any economist, particularly those who have studied the Depression, would agree that those were very important positive steps to stopping the collapse. Now, you could argue that the recovery from 1934 to 41 was actually somewhat halting and included a new recession in 1937-38. And critics could argue, for example, that he didn't do enough with fiscal policy, that he still had a balanced budget mentality. He campaigned for on a balanced budget platform when he ran for president. The other potential concern was that he took some actions that were probably counterproductive. And so one example would be the National Recovery Act, which actually put floors under prices, which was a kind of awkward way to try to stop the deflation. But I think most research today would suggest that that was actually pretty counterproductive.
And what about taxation? What could he have done differently?
I suppose he could have cut taxes, but taxes weren't as high then as they are now. You know, the general recollection people have, or the vision they have of the 30s, was that the government employment programs like the WPA and the building of the Hoover Dam and things like that were a big deal. And they were important, but relative to the size of the problem, they were actually quite small. And as early as the 1950s, economists pointed out that the fiscal programs of the 30s were actually very modest compared to the size of the problem. Ironically, and please take this the right way, the person who sort of most understood fiscal policy in some sense was Adolf Hitler, because the rearming of Germany in the 30s was so big and so extensive Of course, he had other objectives in mind, but the side effect of that rearming, together with a big highway building program, was such that Germany actually came, which had a very deep depression, actually came out of it much quicker than other countries, and suggested that a more aggressive fiscal program would have helped the United States as well. And of course, ultimately, what brought the United States out of the Great Depression was World War II, which was, you know, unintentionally a huge fiscal program.
If there was one central difference you could identify between academic economics, where you spent the first few decades of your career, and then governmental economics, where you spent the last couple, what would that biggest difference be?
Well, there are many differences. I think the biggest one is just the political context. In academia, you're thinking about economic policies, you know, in terms of what's the absolute best thing one could imagine doing, whereas in Washington or any other political context, you have to think about how can you sell what you want to do to others who are involved in the process. I was surprised by how big a share of my time it took to talk to the administration and to Congress and in general to communicate more broadly to the markets and the public. But I quickly understood it was a big part of my job, and I think I adapted over time.
Although you do write that you never enjoyed giving testimony, why was that?
Well, you know, first of all, it's a stressful situation, but also, you know, testimony is typically not about, you know, learning, not about the legislators learning about the situation. I mean, I think a lot of it is an opportunity for them to express their concerns or their political views or their ideology.
Mr. Bernanke, if you don't mind, would you tell me whether or not you do your own shopping at a grocery store?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so you're aware of the prices. But, you know, this argument that prices are going up about 2%, nobody believes it.
Do you have to be a large, greedy, reckless financial institution to apply for these monies?
There is no subsidy. There is no capital involved. There is no gift involved. And they were often very tense situations and sometimes downright unpleasant. But that being said, while I didn't personally enjoy them, I understood they were essential and, you know, I never avoided them. I did my best. I testified something like 80 times while I was chairman.
In early 2004, so a few years before the crisis, you were still a governor at the Fed. You weren't chairman yet. You gave a speech at the Eastern Economic Association in D.C., and your speech was titled The Great Moderation. And your speech began, one of the most striking features of the economic landscape over the past 20 years or so has been a substantial decline in macroeconomic volatility. And you continued, three types of explanations have been suggested for this dramatic change. You said they were structural change, that is in the economy itself, improved macroeconomic policies, and good luck. And then you generally discounted good luck and also structural change generally and came down firmly on the side of monetary policy. But if that was, in your view then, in 2004, a central cause of the great moderation that we were all enjoying, and then the great moderation suddenly ended and we entered instead a great recession, well, wouldn't the average person be inclined to think that monetary policy was, to a large degree, to blame for the crisis after all?
No, that doesn't follow at all. The way I think about this, you got two tools. You got monetary policy and you got bank regulation. The true policy failing leading up to the great crisis was the regulatory and supervisory side that I'm talking about the regulatory community in general, didn't fully appreciate the risks that were building up, nor did the banks themselves. And they weren't tough enough about preventing them. And so I think that today, for example, I think monetary policy is still good and is working to help keep our economy growing and keep inflation low. But what we've done is we've greatly strengthened the regulatory system. That's the right tool.
Anyone who spends time on YouTube and on particularly libertarian or right-wing quadrants of YouTube will find statements, videos of you, compilations of conversations you had, whether in the media or elsewhere, that as modulated as they may have been, in retrospect appear kind of monstrously wrong. This one goes back to 2005. This was, I believe, from CNBC. This was about the lack of a coming housing bubble. Well, let me play you this little piece of tape.
You can see some types of speculation, investors turning over condos quickly. So those sorts of things you see in some local areas. I'm hopeful that, and I'm confident, in fact, that the bank regulators will pay close attention to the kinds of loans that are being made, making sure that underwriting is done right. But I do think that this is mostly a localized problem and not something that's going to affect the national economy.
What do you think, what do you say when you hear that statement of yours from 2005?
Well, it was partly the result of the fact that I was representing the administration, and then you don't really want to go out and say, you know, run for the hills, right? We were paying attention to the housing situation. We were saying in 2005, 2006, the economy was going to continue to do well. It did do well. 2007 was not a bad year until the end. So what we, you know, the economy was doing okay in a broad sense. What we missed, what we didn't anticipate, was that the decline in house prices and the problems in mortgages would generate this huge panic. So that, you know, I can't deny that. I think that I wouldn't give us a particularly good grade before the fall of 2007. After that, when we began to see what was going on there, we were much more aggressive in responding.
All right. So if you're going to give yourself a letter grade for before and after, what are your letter grades?
C minus and A minus. But I don't, it's really not up to me. I think that... you know, others have to make those judgments. In the end, we did stabilize the system, and the economy has recovered. And the U.S. recovery, while not everything we would like, has been pretty good compared to other industrial countries.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, did Bernanke and the Fed really need to intervene as aggressively as they did?
I mean, how big a probability of a second depression do you need in order to act?
And after Bernanke, how did Anne-Marie Slaughter go from policy wonk to anti-feminist icon?
You know, it was misunderstood. I'm still introduced as, this is Anne-Marie Slaughter, the woman who says women can't have it all.
And if you want more Freakonomics Radio, you can find our podcast archive on iTunes or at Freakonomics.com.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Today we're talking with former Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, and we're giving him a chance to relive the darkest days of his career.
It began really in the summer of 2007. I need to say first that the crisis wasn't fundamentally about subprime mortgages and the like. It was really about the fact that those problems in the subprime mortgage market triggered a much broader financial panic, a financial crisis throughout the whole system. I remember in August of 2007 having breakfast with Secretary Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, Hank Paulson. I would usually have a meal together, breakfast or lunch once a week, and we would often meet either at the Fed or the Treasury and have our oatmeal together. We're both big oatmeal fans, and talk about what was going on. And that particular morning, we were looking at the market developments, and we saw that in Europe, there had been a lot of volatility going on in the markets, and the stock markets had dropped, and there seemed to be a lot of fear. And as we learned, that particular day, a big French bank called BNP Paribas had basically said that there had been no demand for its subprime mortgages. It couldn't determine what they were worth, and they were going to stop, you know, even valuing their assets because nobody wanted to buy. And that was spreading fear through the system. And I went, Paulson and I talked about it. I went to the Fed, and it became clear that things were starting to get a bit hairy. And so we took some actions that day to try to put cash into the system to make sure that interest rates didn't spike too much, and that try to calm down the markets a little bit. But that was one of the first days. And by the way, that particular day, I had been planning the next week to go on a vacation, a beach vacation with our family, and that vacation got canceled, and I really haven't had a vacation. I didn't have a vacation over the 8 years I was chairman, basically.
Things were getting hairier and hairier. First came Bear Stearns.
Bear Stearns was an investment bank that was facing a run. It was losing its funding as people who lent to it short-term were pulling their money out. It was very exposed because it was It had invested a lot in housing and subprime mortgages.
With Bear on the verge of collapse, Bernanke helped broker a deal for J.P. Morgan Chase to buy it, with the Fed providing a $30 billion line of credit.
Bear came unraveled faster than most people would have suspected.
The rescue of Bear Stearns.
They couldn't prevent a run on the bank.
Dominating the entire trading day on Wall Street.
Investors pulling their money. Big hedge funds not doing business with it.
In fact, we haven't seen the Fed do something on a weekend in more than 20 years. It might even be longer than that.
Were you, I couldn't really tell from reading your book, the degree to which you personally were, I guess, surprised or caught off balance by just how overexposed and overleveraged the banks were. If you were very much surprised by that or taken by surprise, was that a function of your just not having come from that world, or was it just the magnitude of the leverage that was really hard to comprehend?
Well, if you had asked, and this is a failing of both the banks and the regulators, including the Fed, if you had asked a big bank in 2006, you know, hypothetically, suppose that house prices were to drop 30%, what would happen to your balance sheet? How much would you lose? They would have had a lot of trouble giving you a plausible answer because they were exposed not just through the mortgages they held, but also through various kinds of derivative contracts, through off-balance sheet investments that they had made, through their investments in other companies. Very complicated, lots of different businesses, and they just didn't have enough of a grip.
And it was still getting worse. Several months after the Bear Stearns rescue, Lehman Brothers, a huge and historic financial services firm, went bankrupt. This time, there was no Fed rescue. Then came another foundering firm, the massive insurance company AIG.
New developments surrounding AIG. Standard & Poor's downgrading its rating on AIG.
An unprecedented move to save the financial world from meltdown.
They insure everything from cars to corporations to you name it.
I think it's important to understand that we didn't give them $85 billion. We made them a loan of $85 billion, and we got all the money back with interest. I talk in the beginning of the book about how Secretary Paulson and I went to Congress to explain to an ad hoc group of legislators, you know, what we were doing, why we had to stop AIG from failing, you know, how we were going to approach that. At the end of this process, Senator Harry Reid, who was the majority leader of the Senate, basically told us that we appreciate your coming and explaining all this to us, but just so you understand, you don't have Congress's approval, and this is all on you, basically. It's your call, your decision, your responsibility. And the next day, there was a wire story which said, you know, Republicans and Democrats bury the hatchet right into Ben Bernanke, you know. And then, of course, later on, there was the big blow up over the bonuses that AIG paid to some of their traders. And for many people, that company symbolized, you know, everything that went wrong in the crisis.
But in retrospect, even in retrospect, you sound as though you still believe you had to do what you did, correct?
Oh, absolutely. And we were, if anything, were, when I say we, I mean, again, Geithner and Paulson and I were very much on the side of, no, it's not safe to let him fail. It's just going to make the panic much worse and really have a bad effect on the whole economy. And so, in retrospect, it's evidently clear that we had to do something to prevent these companies from failing. Now, unfortunately, we didn't have a really good set of tools to do that, and I'm happy to say that the regulatory reforms that took place after the crisis have put some tools in place so we won't ever have to do this kind of weekend ad hoc intervention again. And so I think that substantially it was clearly right, but politically it was poison.
I can see why you'd say it's evidently clear that letting them fail would have fueled the panic. But the fact is we don't have the counterfactual. We can't know the counterfactual. So just persuade me why it is so evidently clear. In other words, let's say that Lehman, Bear, and AIG had all been allowed to absolutely disintegrate. As an economist, I mean, what economists are always telling us is, well, these failures are really necessary to make the market fair, make it work, and that by bailing out and so on, you create moral hazard by telling these institutions that, you know what, no matter how deep you get, there may be a rescue. So persuade me that you're right.
Well, as I say, I was there. We had an experiment. The experiment was the collapse of Lehman, which we tried desperately to prevent but were unable to prevent. When it collapsed, the panic by all kinds of objective indicators in terms of the volatility in markets and the collapse of credit and so on, jumped to a whole new level. And immediately after that, the global economy began to fall off a cliff. I mean, almost immediately. The fourth quarter of 2008, which followed Lehman, was the worst quarter really since the early 1930s. It was a terrible collapse. Millions and millions of jobs got lost. And then the first quarter of 2009 was also very, very bad. We intervened, took various actions, including the passage of the TARP bill, which allowed the government to put capital into banks to try to stabilize them. But, you know, and after we intervened and the system began to stabilize in the spring of 2009, then the recession stopped and we began to grow again in the second half of 2009. So the timing is almost perfect. So look, from a policy point of view, I mean, how big a probability of a second depression do you need in order to act? I mean, I think 25% would be enough, but in my view, it was probably about 90% that if the panic had not been arrested, that the depression we had would have been much, much worse.
You've said you wished there had been more punishment, I guess prison time really, for some people who helped create the financial crisis. It sounds as though you can really identify with a kind of general view that people who did things that shouldn't be rewarded either got rewarded or didn't get punishment the way they might have. You now, having served in office for a bunch of years, now are a private citizen. You can go on the lecture market, which I know you've done. I've read that your first talk in Abu Dhabi, you received about $250,000 for that talk. Correct me if any of this is incorrect. There are those people who say, you know, he may have done a good job after the crisis hit, but gosh, I sure wish he'd done a better job of forestalling it or foreseeing it. And I don't like the idea that someone like him and then a bunch of other people who actually were more contributory to the crisis itself don't, I don't like to see them rewarded or at least not suffer. What do you say to that general sentiment?
Well, what I said, and you didn't quote me right, what I said was that I objected to the way that the Department of Justice went about their investigation. I think if people break the law, and whether they're bankers or, you know, pickpockets, whatever they are, I think they should face the consequences. I think what the Department of Justice did, for reasons which I don't fully understand, was at least in some cases it chose to pursue institutional remedies. That is, it would say, well, this bank, you know, there were a lot of bad loans made and a lot of shady practices, and so we're going to fine the bank, which means the shareholders, you know, billions of dollars, instead of investigating individual culpability. So I think that we missed out an opportunity to find out more about what, you know, individuals did and what individuals had responsibilities. You can have bad things happen. You know, if a plane crashes, it doesn't mean that somebody necessarily, you know, sabotaged the plane. It could have been a series of mistakes and errors. And I'm sure that mistakes and errors were very important in the crisis, including on the regulatory side. But to the extent that there was fraudulent behavior or market rigging or whatever, that should be investigated. I'm totally in favor of that.
So you're at Brookings now. I read you're an advisor to a couple of investment firms, PIMCO and Citadel. You do public speaking. I'm curious, will you teach again? Will you perhaps start a podcast? What's in your future?
Well, I've been doing a little blogging, as you may know.
I enjoy your blog very much, too. Yeah.
Thank you. Good. Besides that, you know, I just finished this book, The Courage to Act, the book about my experiences and my time in Washington. So I think I'm going to take a little bit of time to relax and breathe and think about what's next.
I thank you so much. I'll call you Mr. Chairman, even though you've given me permission to call you Ben just because it seems more appropriate. But Mr. Chairman, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
Maybe I'm reading between the lines, but my largest impression from speaking with Ben Bernanke is that he feels that his work during the financial crisis and the work of many people around him, surely, is wildly underappreciated. That he happened to be on call when a ferocious storm slammed into the global economy. And even though it got very, very ugly for a while and remains ugly in some places, that it could have easily gone beyond ugly had it not been for some very smart and cool under pressure responses. Indeed, some courageous responses by his reckoning. Again, his book is called The Courage to Act. We'll never know what would have happened if the Fed and Treasury didn't do what they did, but I will say this. It's always easier to shout about the things that have gone wrong than to appreciate what hasn't gone wrong. I've been thinking about this a lot lately after the terrorist attacks in Paris and elsewhere. Every attack produces the predictable cycle of shock and then the recrimination and finger-pointing, sometimes as much at law enforcement and intelligence and military officials as at the perpetrators. But what about when those same officials prevent a terrorist attack? Our appreciation is generally muted and short-lived. We forget about the catastrophe that was a hair's breadth from happening, and we move on, kind of like we've moved on from the financial crisis that Ben Bernanke helped steer us through. Anne-Marie Slaughter has had her own crises to steer through, though of a very different nature than Bernanke's. In July of 2012, she wrote an essay for The Atlantic called Why Women Still Can't Have It All. The subtitle read, "It's time to stop fooling ourselves," says a woman who left a position of power. "The women who have managed to be both mothers and top professionals are superhuman, rich, or self-employed. If we truly believe in equal opportunity for all women, here's what has to change." This quickly became one of the most widely read articles and most widely argued about articles in the long history of The Atlantic.
Noted American feminist Anne-Marie Slaughter.
And Anne-Marie Slaughter
created a storm.
An extraordinary reaction. A lot of pushback, a lot of enthusiastic support as well.
Why women still can't have it all is causing quite the debate.
Can women really have it all when it comes to career and to family?
Why women still can't have it all.
Her article, published in the Atlantic Monthly, started a conversation that continues still to this very day.
It was overwhelming. It really was overwhelming. It was like a tsunami. And I'm on the front page of the New York Times juxtaposed against Sheryl Sandberg. My mother calls up and says, "What have you done?"
Up to that point, Slaughter was a highly regarded, if not highly visible, academic and foreign policy wonk. If she got a media request, it was to talk about her views on the Middle East, the revolution in Libya, or the war in Syria. But overnight, her more than 30 years as a foreign policy scholar were trumped by this one article about work-life balance.
And to this day, I'm better known for that than anything I've done in foreign policy. And it created a new set of opportunities, but it also created a new set of obligations where I felt like, well, now I have to continue this conversation. I can't just walk away from it.
So let's continue that conversation right now. First, a bit of background.
I am currently the president and CEO of New America, which is a think tank and a civic enterprise that focuses on trying to solve America's problems in the digital age. And I have been, for much of my life, a professor, a law professor originally at Chicago and Harvard, and then a dean of the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton. And then I was director of policy planning from 2009 to 2011 at the State Department under Hillary Clinton.
I'd love you to just describe that job. I assume it's a position that had been around. If not, let us know. And what was your actual portfolio there?
What you are, you're really running the State Department's internal think tank. I mean, what it is are the longer-term thinkers at the State Department for whatever the Secretary of State wants. When I was there, Secretary Clinton wanted a massive review of our diplomacy and our development to think about how we could shift our foreign policy to include more development. And it was a huge report. I worked on it for 18 months, but we did everything else too. So my portfolio included everything Secretary Clinton was working on or wanted us to work on.
Slaughter took the job with a reputation for arguing that American values are not only part of a national identity, but a strategy.
And that means I have taken a strong stand on things like intervening in Libya, where I thought we had to prevent a massacre, where I've been incredibly strong on taking action in Syria because it was predictable that the country was coming apart in what is now the greatest humanitarian disaster of our time. There are people who see me as, they call me a liberal hawk. I don't agree with that. I am a liberal. But I would say I focus on people. I focus on American values. And I'm a realist in terms of the things we can't do. But I am definitely somebody who stands for doing what we think is right in the world.
When Slaughter and I spoke in the middle of September, the Syrian war and refugee situation were on the front page of just about every newspaper. She was an early advocate of American intervention in Syria and made her position known on a variety of news programs.
Are we going to do nothing? What? Really nothing?
It is possible to have a no-fly zone or to have safe zones. What we need, first of all, is to just end the killing. The next thing we could do is we could take out their air force.
What's it like for you to be sitting here to have wanted to intervene much more directly in Syria, not been part of a team that took that direction, and seeing the aftermath?
Intensely frustrating. It is just agonizing to see the paper every day because this was so completely predictable. And it has been predictable. You know, we've got a government that's been using chemical weapons, that's been dropping barrel bombs on its people. Now what's happening is even the Syrian government supporters are fleeing. But this goes to a point that I have made over and over and over again, that the divide between strategic interests and humanitarian interests is a false one, that you could see that where a country's population is, you know, being driven out of their homes and being massacred by their governments, sooner or later, very bad things will happen. Extremists will move in and people will move out. And then that becomes a national security interest. And that's what we're seeing right now. But it was predictable and we could have done something to stop it and we didn't. And now the problem is so much worse.
A lot of your emails to and from your boss, your then boss, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, have been released lately in the big release. Curious what we've gone through them. We can't find anything remotely salacious from you, I have to say. I was a little bit disappointed. You seem to be quite an upstanding citizen. But what's the experience been like for you to see your work correspondences become public in a way that you perhaps hadn't intended?
Well, you know, I have to say I haven't gone through all of them. I've seen some of them. You know, I clearly did write thinking I was writing only to her. But I would say in general that I'm not upset at having my correspondence public. I mean, I don't think it's a good idea as a general matter. I mean, you know, any government official depends on being able to receive advice from people. And if you're constantly worrying that it's going to be made public, what will happen is, you know, you'll trim your sails. So I don't think it's a good public policy to publish all of this. But I'm willing to stand by anything I wrote and to explain that, you know, I knew she was getting lots of other advice and that I felt like, you know, you should hear this point of view.
You wrote to Secretary Clinton, "You did a great job on Meet the Press. The only thing I would add is when they ask you about the relationship between you and the White House, you can say not only that you are the diplomat in chief and the implementer, but also the architect of the strategies we need actually to achieve the objectives and the visions that the president lays out." So talk to me about why. I mean, presumably she's the Secretary of State. She knows
yes.
This. What were you trying to communicate either just below the lines or maybe way below the lines there?
Well, this is something I've thought a lot about. As the National Security Council expands, the State Department consistently, and USAID and the Pentagon, the other agencies really are constantly trying to make sure they still play the role they're supposed to play, which is the president sets the direction, right? George W. Bush, he's the decider. So on Syria, good example, I may really disagree with his decision, but he gets to call the shots. He ought to be setting policy at that level. And then the State Department, because the State Department is the place that has the expertise. And, of course, the people. The National Security Staff is really small. The State Department is big. Then the Secretary of State should then say, okay, how are we going to accomplish what the president wants us to do? So when I said that she could say she's the architect of the strategy, it's we should be the place that is then creating the strategy to accomplish what the White House wants us to do. And of course, you know, the National Security Council should be involved in that, but they shouldn't be actually creating the strategy. They don't have the bandwidth, they don't have the expertise, and they don't have the depth.
Do you think it's also part of this general philosophy of the American presidency, and not all presidencies are like this, to create the appearance that, you know, all power runs through the president?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's just, you know, once you've created a White House bureaucracy, because that's what you're talking about. The old executive office building is the White House bureaucracy. It inevitably, power starts to flow to the center. And I think it's very bad for American government, because you actually are disempowering the very people who have the expertise and who engage with Congress. Remember, you know, all those departments are the ones that engage with Congress on a daily basis. So the American people are represented. But I think it's just once you start creating a staff, inevitably they think, well, you know, we want to do it. And then the president thinks, well, I want to control it.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, why Anne Marie Slaughter left one of the great foreign policy jobs after just 2 years.
Our elder son was making some bad choices, really bad choices, and he was in middle school.
Also, in order for women to have it all, do men need to be resocialized?
I think I prefer expand choices and roles to resocialize, which does sound vaguely Orwellian.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
After 2 years as Director of Policy Planning in the U.S. State Department, Anne Marie Slaughter announced that she'd be returning to Princeton.
I had succeeded in my job, and I could have been a candidate for promotion. I don't know if I would have gotten a higher job, but Secretary Clinton had made clear, you know, I could put myself up for promotion. So the decision I made was I can stay here and try to get an even higher job, and this is something, you know, I've wanted all my life, or I can go back to being a professor. And I would not have done that if I didn't have children at home. I would have stayed in Washington.
Let's just take 1 minute and set the stage. Your family had been living in Princeton.
Yes.
You'd moved down to D.C. for the job, and you were commuting back on weekends, essentially?
Yes. Yes. I was leaving at 5 a.m. every Monday morning, and I was coming home sometime late on Friday. And so I was only home on Saturday and Sunday. And my husband, who is a professor at Princeton, was, you know, being the lead parent, the only parent at home during the week. But our elder son was making some bad choices, really bad choices. And he was in middle school.
He wasn't doing his homework. He was failing math, being disruptive in class. By eighth grade, he was suspended from school. He'd even been picked up by the local police.
And I realized that, you know, I just needed to go home, that I didn't know that going home was going to turn everything around. I mean, my husband had been doing his best, and this was a real challenge, but I felt like he needed all hands on deck.
Did it turn everything around? How much did your coming home change the situation with your son, your family?
Well, so this is an interesting question. So my son, I am happy to report, just started college at Northwestern University, and he
Congratulations. That's
yes,
great.
We're thrilled, and he's thrilled. So he's in a great place. I do not want to say, you know, I came home and everything was great. I mean, that is just not fair to my husband, and I don't think it's true. What I will say is I think it definitely made a difference. I think it was important to my son to know that I was willing to put him first. But I can't say that he might not have kind of, you know, grown out of that phase. Plenty of teenagers go through that phase and they grow out of it. I know that it was the right choice for me and for my family. And I think my son is happy about it, although there is, at some point about a year after I'd come home, he was reading about Syria, and he turned to me and he said, "Mom, if you'd stayed in the State Department, could you have fixed Syria or could you have saved Syria?" And I said, "No." You know, like, no, it's not that simple.
Now, you told him that because it was true, or you told him that because you didn't want him to feel guilty?
I told him that because it was true.
The Atlantic essay that Slaughter wrote about her dilemma produced a vigorous response. Some people thanked her for pointing out what should be obvious, that when it comes to family obligations, we expect more of professional women than professional men. But some people thought that she was a traitor to the feminist cause, that if a woman as well-credentialed and well-situated as Anne Marie Slaughter had to put aside her dream career, what did that mean for the average working-class woman? And that was just the public response. It was what she heard from people she knew that really surprised her.
What they thought depended on what I said, and this is really what I learned. Because if I said to people, my 2-year public service leave was up and I came back because otherwise I'd lose my tenure, people were fine with that. Larry Summers did that, right? Giving up tenure at an Ivy League university, you know, most people understand why you wouldn't want to do that. So if I said that, there was no problem. Everybody was like, great, you know, you had a great job in government and you've, served and now you're back at in a great job. If I said, I came home, my leave was up and, you know, I have 2 teenagers at home and I didn't want to miss, you know, their time at home and it was important for me to be here now, I got a very different reaction. And that was fairly shocking to me. And I deliberately would raise that because I all my life I've believed, you know, I'm a foreign policy professional, I'm an academic, I'm a scholar, I was a dean, and I'm a mother and a wife and a daughter. And that part of my life is just as important. And I would get a kind of either what a pity, which was like the opposite of what I was trying to say, which was no, this is a very important choice, I'm also a mother. Or I would get a kind of, I could see this kind of reassessment, like, whoa, I guess, you know, either they didn't believe me and they thought I must not have succeeded, which is, I say, you know, in Washington, if you say you're leaving to spend time with your family, it's a euphemism for being fired. Or you could see people just thinking, she must not really be, you know, a player. She must not be the person I thought she was, because if she was, she clearly would still be in D.C.
Slaughter had written several foreign policy books, including The Idea That Is America and A New World Order. But now she set out to write a very different kind of book. It's called Unfinished Business. It's a call for making the workplace truly equitable for women and men. The book grew directly out of the Atlantic piece.
The book is about, okay, we're stuck. I mean, it's unfinished business, women, men, work, family, and the unfinished business is the unfinished business of the movement for full equality between men and women. And, you know, in a nutshell, what I'm arguing is that if we're going to get to real equality between men and women, we have to focus less on women and more on elevating the value of care and expanding the choices and roles for men. And that's sort of counterintuitive, right? Because what we've been doing is we measure our progress in the women's movement by how many women CEOs we have, women leaders of all kinds, women politicians. And I'm all for having more women in high places. Don't get me wrong. I'm all for it. We need it. But that metric and that focus is not going to get us there because it's leaving a huge number of women out, all the women at the bottom. And it's assuming that you can get to equality between men and women by changing women's roles, but not changing men's roles.
Right. The phrase you use is that we need to re-socialize men, which, as a man, sounds vaguely threatening, but not really. But what do you? But you write about it not only adult men who are in the workforce and, you know, maybe those CEOs we're talking about, but also young men, boys. You
yes.
know,
yes.
And how they should think about the future work world and the future family world as well. What are some of the kind of basic signposts that we need to rearrange or get rid of, or maybe the new ones we need to have written?
So let me start by saying how I got to this realization that we have to, I think I prefer expand choices and roles to re-socialize, which does sound vaguely Orwellian. So here's what I realized. I have two sons, and I looked at my sons and I thought, you know, if I'd had a daughter, we'd be raising her 100% differently than the way my mother was raised, and even differently than I was raised, although my father was very progressive and he raised me to have a career. But if I looked at my sons, I thought, you know, I'm raising my sons pretty much exactly the way my father was raised. I mean, we're raising them to have a more active role as fathers. You know, my father never changed a diaper. Certainly my husband changed plenty, and I expect my sons to. But we're still saying to men, your worth in society is a function of your breadwinning. It's a function of how much money you can make and how high you can rise in your career. And that is this very limited set of choices. It's the flip side of saying to women, when my mother was raised, you know, your worth in society depends on can you get married and can you have children? And my point is, all of us should have access to both. As a woman, I absolutely want to be able to compete. I want to have a career that's been fabulous. But I sure don't want to do that at the expense of also being a mother and a wife and a sister and a daughter. And so to men, what I now say to my sons is, you know, if you believe in equality and you marry a woman or a man, whatever, whoever, and you believe that you're going to support that woman's career, then it may require you being the lead parent and your spouse to be the lead breadwinner. And that's been the situation in our marriage. And they understand that I couldn't have a big career unless Andy played that role. So that's the place where I'm really saying to men, you know, if you believe in equality, it can't be, okay, I believe in equality, but I'm going to take every promotion I get. And, you know, if you get a promotion, I'm not going to move for you.
In the book, you acknowledge the criticism that this work-life balance conversation often becomes kind of an upper-class
yes.
conversation. And you acknowledge that, look, you have an elite position currently. You grew up in very comfortable circumstances. You had great schooling. You had great educational and job opportunities, and you've taken advantage of them. You've worked hard. I don't mean to disparage them at all. But how can someone very much on the other end of the, let's call it the opportunity
yes.
spectrum, and let's say it's a single mom, how can that population think about this issue divorced from, you know, all the trappings of privilege?
Yes. I talk about the competitive mystique, or the, you know, the bias against people who are giving care. It hurts women at the top if they take time out or work part-time or stop working. It hurts them. It hurts their career. It hurts women at the bottom so much more, because a single mom whose child is sick can lose her job because she doesn't have paid sick days. So the fact that we don't accommodate care, and the fact, more importantly, that we don't provide affordable, quality daycare for her to put her children in, or early education, or after-school programs, or paid maternity leave, all of that means that the woman at the bottom, single moms, are the poorest people in our society. So I point out that we have too few women at the top, but we have far too many women at the bottom. And if you focus on care, you can find solutions that help the women at the bottom as much as the women at the top.
And finally, let's pretend for a moment that Hillary Clinton is elected president in 2016. What are the odds that you are back in D.C. with a government job? And what would the what job would you like? I mean, would you want to be Secretary of State? I can't imagine that wouldn't be a blast.
So I've been in Washington far too long to answer that question. I mean, I have made no secret of the fact that, I love foreign policy and I'm committed to foreign policy, but there are so many imponderables, partly on the home front and partly in terms of the organization I run. I would say I would love to be in a high foreign policy position again at some point in my life, but I'm not expecting or anticipating any immediate changes.
All right, we'll just have to keep our eye on you then.
Well, I've enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
That's it for our show this week. Thanks for listening. If you would like more Freakonomics Radio, please visit our podcast archive at freakonomics.com, or you can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.